This Valentine's Day, Dunkin's got the perfect pairings to show your love. So get down on one knee with a dozen brownie batter donuts and a cocoa mocha signature latte. Or make them swoon with a strawberry dragon fruit Dunkin' refresher with a Cupid's Choice donut. Are you ready for love? America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer.
This is Emmanuel Probst, and I'm the author of Assemblage, the Art and Science of Brand Transformation. And you're listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which has been named as one of the top marketing podcasts by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message that you're a listener, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. This episode is sponsored by Marketing Architects, creators of the all-inclusive TV advertising concept that's so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. I'll tell you more and how to get a copy of the book in a few minutes. Now, let's get on with the show. Today, we welcome Emmanuel Probst to talk about his book, Assemblage, The Art and Science of Brand Transformation, published by Idea Press. Emmanuel Probst is the global lead brand thought leadership at Ipsos, adjunct professor at the University of California at Los Angeles, and the author of the Wall Street Journal and USA Today bestseller, Brand Hacks, How to Build Brands by Fulfilling the Consumer Quest for Meaning. At Ipsos, Emmanuel supports numerous Fortune 500 companies by providing them with a full understanding of their customers' journey, and his clients span a wide range of industries, including technology, consumer packaged goods, retail, financial services, and advertising agencies. Emmanuel also teaches consumer market research at UCLA. Go Bruins. And he writes about consumer psychology for numerous publications. He earned an MBA in marketing and a doctorate in consumer psychology. And interesting fact, he's originally from France.
I'm French.
Dr. Probst, congratulations on Assemblage and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Doug, this is the best introduction I ever heard. Thank you so much. This is amazing.
Well, feel free to take me on the road to introduce you when you give keynote speeches. So,
absolutely, I will.
Yeah, and I was very excited and nervous to find out that you're actually a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast. And to that, I said, "Ooh, I really need to up my game." These people like you listening in. But before we get to your book, can I just ask you one personal question? Because I've already started to tell people a little bit about you. Is your favorite Christmas carol, O Come, Emmanuel?
It is indeed. I am actually, each time I hear it, it triggers something in me. And so I have to say it's an emotional moment every year around Christmas. Absolutely, it is.
Wow. Okay. Well, it's not Christmas, but I think now whenever I hear that song, I'm going to think about Emmanuel Probst. So you see how that works? Anyway, you live in California, and I would love to live in California, and I'm going to tell you why. Ain't no party like a West Coast party, 'cause the West Coast party don't stop. That's the only reason I would live there, along with the lower humidity than what we have here on the East Coast. So I was delighted to see that the book is endorsed by a number of big hitters, authors I've had the honor of interviewing, including Nir Eyal and Jonah Berger and Rory Sutherland, David Acker, Martin Lindstrom, and Neil Hoyne. Boy, it's like an all-star game. So I wanted to ask you one thing, though. Now, I don't speak French, but I noticed that you had, at the very beginning of the book, it's like a
quote. Yes.
A quote, yeah. And it's a lyric from Julian Clerc, and I want to play it for the people who are familiar with him and who speak French and ask you to explain what it is. Je veux être utile à vivre et à rêver. So what is he singing about there?
It's fantastic that you pull this song, Doug. I'm very impressed with your podcast and with how much effort you put into researching your offers and everything. The song is about what's the point of a song. That's literally the lyrics. He says, what is the point of a song? And he says, I, as a singer, as a musician, I want to be useful to live and to dream. And this song is also very meaningful to me because, and I don't want to go dark here, but a few years ago, you may remember that there were some terrorist attacks in France and they played the song for the French president. He sang the song for the French president in south of France to remember the victims.
Was this the Charlie Hebdo?
It was after. It was
incident?
Yeah, it was after Charlie Hebdo. It was a few years later. It was in south of France. But it's, for that reason, this song also has a, is very meaningful. I think it's a very, very meaningful song. And I'm thinking, Doug, that to me, a good song, like a good book, or the other way around, what makes a good book and what makes a good song is for it to still be relevant years later. Because I don't know when he wrote this song, but look.
I think it was 1992 that he wrote it.
Well, see, you got it.
There's a lot of useless information stored in my mental hard drive. So
I don't think that's useless. I think that's – so that's 31 years ago. That sounds about right because I was young at the time.
You were a teenager.
And all this to, yeah, all this to say that the song is – still very relevant today, if not more relevant today. And again, I think to me, that is what a good book is. A good book is a book that's relevant today and will be as relevant, if not more relevant, in 5 years, 7, 10 years.
Hear, hear. I agree completely. Let me quote from the beginning to give folks a little sample of what's ahead. You write, this book will show you how to emulate the bond assemblage, which we're going to talk about. It will teach you the art and science of assembling brands that thrive by transforming their customers and making a positive impact on the world. In the 1960s, advertising legend David Ogilvy asserted that senior advertising executives and so-called creative people did not have a monopoly on great ideas. He argued that some of the best ideas come from junior employees, researchers, and everyday people. I wrote assemblage with Ogilvy in mind. Through his exploratory journey, you will learn from talented marketers such as the team behind James Bond, the Houdini brothers, Dr. Evil.
Throw me a frickin' bone here. I'm the boss. Need the info.
Lil McKella, Taylor Swift, and DJ Khaled. You'll also discover case studies from a range of big and small brands, including Gucci, Ruinart, Omsum, and Pharaoh and Ball. Whether you are a marketer or not, assemblage will give you the confidence to create great brands that drive profit for your business, feel personal and relevant to your customers, and make a positive impact on society. So let's get back to Emmanuel Probst. Dr. Probst, you are, by all measures, an international man of mystery, okay? And let's talk about another international man of mystery, and I'm not talking about my spirit animal, Austin Powers.
Oh, behave.
I'm talking about the original Mac Daddy.
Bond. James Bond.
What is the connection between James Bond and assemblage?
The James Bond movie franchise is a fantastic example of an assemblage, and here's why. Because James Bond, the core brand, is still here. You have, he's a British spy and he's here to fight evil and he wants to do the right thing. So the core brand, he still has his gadgets and his cars and Q and M and his entourage, if you will. And so those are the foundations of the James Bond brand and the movie franchise. And it has evolved over time. So James Bond is about, I think, 38 movies. He's been around for a number of years, but the brand evolved whereby, well, today Q, who puts together his gadgets, is a gay male. And Miss Moneypenny, his boss's secretary, is no longer a very proper public school British white woman. She's now black. And also James Bond no longer fights the KGB as he did in the earlier movies. He tends now to fight a overarching digital evil, if you will, and so on and so forth. And that's an example of an assemblage because the core identity of the brand is still here, yet the brand has evolved in a dynamic fashion to adapt to society and to adapt to today's culture. As such, it makes it still very relevant and therefore very successful because not only people watch the movies, almost half of the world has watched a James Bond movie at one point in time, but also the brand partnerships are so successful, whether it's on the higher end of the market with the likes of Aston Martin and Omega, but also with some more accessible brands, if you will. So that's what makes the success of James Bond, and as such, is a great example of an assemblage.
Whenever an author writes about alcohol, it really gets my attention. So could you talk about the origins of assemblage and cognac so people can better understand more about that word? Because it was a new word for me.
Yeah. When one makes cognac or a wine or champagne, or if you make bourbon, or if you make whiskey, well, most of the time, in fact, always when it comes down to bourbon, cognac, you pick and choose from a wide range of brandies, meaning whatever you're drinking, that's not one single unique product. It is a combination, also known as an assemblage, of a range of brandies from different aging processes, from different grapes, from different soils, from different barrels, from different methodologies to get to the product. And the work of the maître de chais is the individual who creates that blend. The master blender, his work is to pick and choose from those different brandies to create a product that is unique, that is salient, yet is on brand, a product that is distinctive and aligns with the brand. And that's where the title comes from. It is to say we can and we should create brands the way we create a great bourbon or a great cognac, by assembling elements from culture and from psychology and from commerce in a coherent fashion so that we create a brand that is a sustainable stream of revenue and that will stand for something clear and salient in the long run.
Yes, and throughout the book, I would think you encourage people to go a little further than they might have thought they could to get inspiration for building a relevant brand. But let me ask you something from the very beginning. If you could explain this, you write that many marketers are loath to admit that brands are now open source and struggle to manage the tension between giving away and retaining control.
Correct, and that's because 5, 7, 10 years ago, as brand strategists, as marketers, we had control over the brand. You could, most of the time, dictate what your brand should stand for. Also, yes, because we will control the media channels way better than we do now.
Those were the good old days as a former New York ad guy.
Well, exactly. So the metaphor of Madison Avenue is gone. As you may have heard, Doug, the last agency that was on Madison Avenue left Madison Avenue. That was TBWA. And that's all to say that this control that Madison Avenue had over the audience is just no longer realistic, no longer even relevant, I will say. So here's the deal. 5, 7, 10 years ago, as marketers, you will control the message. You will dictate this message to the audience. Fast tracking to today, you have to engage in a process of co-creation of this brand with your audience. You have to acknowledge and harness the fact that your audience is going to help you shape the brand, and your audience has a lot of leverage to talk back, that is to promote your brand if you do well, to advocate for your brand, or if you do poorly, maybe to cancel your brand, mm-hmm. and it will backfire at you.
Yes, yes. But I found it interesting, I think it was on page 8, if you could explain that how trust in brands are at their lowest points probably ever.
Yeah. Well, that's because we're going back to Madison Avenue. I think for many years, the advertising was about selling more alcohol and tobacco, if you will. And it was about pushing more products down the throats of consumers. And at times, brands have often been, and still are, although their brands are becoming more conscious, but have been disingenuous about their purpose, about what they were really trying to achieve. So the fact that you have an abundance of products and brands around you that historically marketers and advertisers were not necessarily the good guys. They were not here to educate. And the fact that brands have been disingenuous at times, that is why at the end of the day, or as of now, the trust in brands is pretty underwhelming.
Yes, but Emmanuel, at least when I go to hell, I'll be with all my advertising friends.
There we go.
So let me just add to that. You say, this is from a Havas study, 75% of brands could disappear overnight and people would easily replace them. 71% of participants have little faith that brands deliver on their promises, and only 34% believe brands are transparent about their commitments, and less than half of brands are seen as trustworthy. Now, I know that sounds frightening to a lot of people, but that's a big opportunity. It's great. So try to see the silver lining there. I know this will be frustrating for you because we can't talk about everything in the book, but I wanted to jump to the first chapter, and this is going to be of great interest to people that are really dialed into storytelling. You write that heroes, villains, saviors, and anti-heroes are all relatable and sympathetic in their own ways. Can you talk about how brands can use archetypes like these to appeal to consumers?
Yeah. So in my writing, Doug, I look at marketing advertising through the lens of consumer psychology. In other words, we have plenty of talented brand strategists out there. And of course, I do brand strategy, right? Brand performance, equity, and activation. But my background is in consumer psychology. And that's all to say that I start with people, not even consumers, and certainly not marketers. I start with people in mind. And the chapter you are referring to, chapter 1, is about anti-heroes, villains, and saviors. And it's to say that they're relatable. Here's the deal. Heroes have superpowers. So we all like Batman and Superman and Spider-Man. However, they're less relatable just because most of us cannot fly. I mean, I cannot jump from one high rise to the other, Doug. Maybe you can.
Have you tried it, Emmanuel?
Well, you know, that's a good point. Maybe in my dreams, right?
There you go.
Next time I'll go midtown Manhattan, I'll give it a shot.
I don't want to be responsible for that. I don't need Mrs. Probst coming after me.
You wouldn't want that to happen.
No, right. Yeah.
In contrast, and heroes have been the archetype of the hero. We've seen that in advertising many times. And don't get me wrong, it's relevant by all means. What's interesting with anti-heroes is they're relatable because they can accomplish things that are heroic, yet they're also flawed and they wrestle and they try to improve. That's the case of James Bond. James Bond is an anti-hero whereby he can fight evil, yet he's wrestling with alcohol and he has some challenges in his relationships with women and so on and so forth.
Right, and like Don Draper from Mad Men. That's another great example in your book about an anti-hero.
Exactly. Don Draper is a great example of an anti-hero whereby he's a very talented advertising executive. He's an outstanding creative, yet he's struggling with alcohol and his relationship with women and his childhood and many other things. And the same reasoning applies for villains and saviors, whereby you would side with the villains because you feel sorry for them and you played that little clip from Dr. Evil. It was excellent, by the way. I couldn't stop laughing, Doug. Dr. Evil is a good example of a likable villain.
Speaking of France, you know where Dr. Evil's from, right?
You tell me.
Belgium.
Oh, is he? Oh,
Well, shout out to my listeners in Belgium.
Oh, excellent. And, well, saviors, because they can save the world, then in a way, Jeff Bezos and Elon Musk position themselves as modern-day saviors, whereby they'll take you to Mars and Musk can save the planet with clean energy. So I thought it was important to zoom in on those archetypes that are little known and, in my opinion, undervalued, underleveraged in marketing. We see a lot of hero shots, and that's fine. My call to action, the opportunity for marketers is really to illustrate anti-heroes, villains, and saviors, also because consumers are looking for empathy and brands that we can relate to. And you can relate to an anti-hero. It's harder to relate to Batman or Superman.
TV advertising is a powerful channel for business growth, and it's a counterintuitive solution for businesses frustrated by the rising costs of digital marketing. But the traditional process for launching TV campaigns is expensive, time-consuming, and complex. That's why marketing architects flip the traditional process on its head. With all-inclusive TV advertising, they invest their own money to produce, analyze, and optimize your TV campaign. All you pay for is media, setting you up for rapid growth at a significant cost advantage. This approach to TV is so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. It's called All-Inclusive TV, How Booming Brands Are Reimagining TV Advertising. It explores how a variety of brands are using TV to transform their businesses and how you can do the same. For a copy of the book, visit this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com or visit marketingarchitects.com/book and tell them you heard about it on the Marketing Book Podcast. You write that in marketing, the consumer must be positioned as the hero. The consumer must be positioned as the hero, with the brand only there to help and support. I think it's more common to see companies and brands positioning themselves as the hero. Is that your sense as well?
It is, and it is a mistake. Marketers, advertising executives, too often are very bubbled whereby we read the same publications and we talk to people like ourselves, and we are way too knowledgeable about our products and brands. We know way more about our category than anyone does, and we think way more about our category than consumers do. And it's a mistake to position the brand as the hero, because most consumers don't care about most brands. There are very few brands that command a following or a true emotional connection. For most decisions, people don't think about it for that long. And what a brand should do for people, again, not even consumers, people, is transform me. That's the point of the book. The brand is not the hero. The hero is the consumer. I want your brand to take me from who I am to who I want to become. I'm the hero. Your brand is going to facilitate this transformation for me. That's what's important.
Yes, yes. So again, you know, I think it was the next chapter. When you talk about timeless things, this is going to be relevant almost forever. But talk about why we seek reassurance about our past and our present and our future, and how brands can leverage that.
Yeah, so here's the deal. Artificial intelligence and ChatGPT and what Google is doing next, and all this is fascinating, yet it feels threatening to people. And in fact, not just AI, just devices and messaging apps and social media and fear of missing out and Microsoft Teams and all those products that theoretically help us connect with the world around us. And don't get me wrong, we all use those tools, we love them, yet they're actually isolating and threatening. The point is to say technology is great. However, it creates a lot of anxieties for people. And The chapter you're referring to is "We see the world around us feels unsafe and unstable, and we feel threatened by technology, and we feel lost in the sea of apps and devices. Therefore, we as people, we seek a sense of permanence and reassurance about life and death. We want to defy technology, if you will. And that is why historical buildings, for example, are so important and are so meaningful to consumers. For example, in Boston, there is a hotel, the Liberty Hotel, that is a former jail. It was a prison in the past. Or you will see downtown Manhattan, some old nuts and bolts factories that are now very trendy lofts. And mm-hmm. you will see the same thing in Los Angeles and or on the west side of Chicago. It's interesting to see that many of those technology firms we were talking about took over those buildings. That's the case of Google. Google in Chelsea Market took over some buildings there and did a beautiful job remodeling those buildings so that they now host a very forward-thinking technology company. So that's all to say that we love old things. That is why also nostalgia is so successful in marketing, because it takes you back to a time that is comforting and reassuring.
Are there some things related to that that can help brands become more empathetic?
Yes, it's understanding that people are overwhelmed and understanding that people want to get to what's most important to them and what is most meaningful to them. So it's going to be about quality, not quantity. I think that is really what we should look forward to as marketing professionals, as advertising professionals, as brands. How can I establish a meaningful emotional connection with my audience? Not so much just blasting ads and pushing people down the funnel. That's not sustainable.
Well, let's jump to another interesting part. I think it's chapter 5. You write that in marketing, what matters is how people perceive the brand, not what the brand and the product really are. And a key part of a brand's assemblage is a reason to believe, RTB. And is it right that at the most basic level, the RTB is why your customers should believe you? RTB is about gaining a unique position in someone's mind and heart. What are some of the things that make brands, you know, claims and promises more credible and trustworthy?
Yeah, so this chapter is perception is the truth. And it's to tell readers, as you said, well, what's important is what we perceive the brand to be. In consumer psychology, it's to say we construct our own truths based on our perception of the world and based on the information we are exposed to, and in a way, what we want the truth to be. And in this chapter, I look into fake news and the truth and how it spreads and so on and so forth. And what brands can do, and you said in your introduction, Doug, that, well, or rather I say in my book, and you mentioned this in the introduction, that people don't trust brands. Well, that's because brands have too often been disingenuous. So to address your question precisely, brands need to make claims that they can support. A typical example is greenwashing. It's great for brands to engage with sustainability and to become more conscious about the world. Your story has to add up, though, as a brand. So you cannot and you should not undertake a sustainability challenge that is either irrelevant and or too big for you to tackle. Right? So when you see brands saying that they'll be carbon neutral by 2030 and 2035, it has to be realistic. It has to be relatable. We at Ipsos see in our studies that those claims don't necessarily resonate well with people. First, because 2035 feels like it's in 12 years from today, but it feels really far down the line. Also, because if you are an airport and you claim that you will be carbon neutral, I don't care if it's 2030 or 2035, it's pretty hard to believe you as an airport brand. Why? Because an airport is an operation that obviously creates a lot of pollution. So when you add small print and to say, well, hold on a minute, it's the airport building that will be carbon neutral, not the airport. See, that's where brands lose trust with consumers. Mm-hmm. It's when you need the small prints and when you need disclaimers over four pages. So stand by your claim and adopt a brand purpose and a mission that is realistic to achieve.
Yes, tell the truth. Oh, I think, you know, it's sort of like there's this muscle memory in the marketing or business world, thinking that you can get away with these sort of things. And I think, you know, in the years ahead, people will realize they're going to have to be more transparent. Actually, we can talk about that in a minute. There's some very interesting things in the latter half of the book about that. Related to that, can you explain the aesthetic usability effect? I was not familiar with that.
Well, aesthetics are so important, and that is one good thing social media and technology has brought to us, is what we call visual literacy. That's particularly relevant with Instagram. What this means is people have a culture of images and an ability to create, understand, interpret, decipher, process pictures and images that has grown, if you will. I'm not saying we did not have that 20, 30 years ago, but has greatly developed. And that is something that is better, that younger generations do better than the older guys like you and I, Doug, because they grew with this culture of visual literacy, seeing the world through the lens of the camera. And as such, aesthetics of products and brands are even more so important than ever before, because people no longer read a 3,500 words article. I mean, they do, but that's becoming pretty niche. And in advertising, remember, again, going back to Madison Avenue, you would have full pages with like 300, 400, 700 words of text in an ad. And now you need more pictures. And frankly, you need more videos and 3D effects than you need copy. All these are good news. That means as a marketing professional, as a brand strategist, as a brand, as an advertising professional, you really have to harness, understand, leverage the power of the aesthetics of the brand, of the products, of the colors, of the pictures.
Yes, let me add to that. You're right. The aesthetic usability effect refers to a phenomenon in which consumers perceive a product with a more aesthetic design as easier to use than a product with a less aesthetic design. It seemed to me like that goes right to the subconscious. People might not even be able to articulate that in a focus group, but it talked about the importance of good design, and that could be the product, certainly a website, or pretty much any interaction that people have with your brand.
Well, a good example for our listeners here, Doug, is a brand called OXO. OXO mm-hmm. is a brand of kitchen gadgets, right? And who needs a can opener, right? You can buy a can opener at the dollar store for $1, or at the pound store in the UK for £1, or at the euro store in France for €1. Okay. And so the functional benefit of a product is really quite underwhelming. You just expect the can opener to open your can. Yet OXO can charge 10, 15 times the price of a basic can opener, and people buy them not because they want to pay more, not because they need a can opener, but because those products are so well designed with such a great empathy and understanding of consumers. So as such, I think that's one brand, there are many others, but that's one brand that exemplifies the importance of product aesthetics and how successful it can make you as a brand.
Yes, and I plead guilty to that. I have a $10 OXO can opener, and I'm very happy to have bought it. So I wanted to read a quote from Harry Houdini. You write, "The secret of showmanship consists not of what you really do, but what the mystery-loving public thinks you do." What can magicians teach us about branding?
I think that's so important. I think that's what branding is about. It should be about the magic. If you want your product to stand out, what magicians can teach us is exactly that, is to do so much hard work in the background, to do so much hard work to get your trick right, if you will, and to present things in a way that are compelling, to also create some mystery and some intrigue about the product. For example, in magic, something that's really important is the reveal. And it's the same thing in marketing and in advertising, in my opinion. How do you reveal the product? How do you present this product so that it generates an emotional reaction?
Like when you open the box?
Exactly. To your point, unboxing is a big thing on YouTube, and it's a big thing on TikTok and other social media. An example of a brand that does well is Glossier. Glossier is a brand of personal care, beauty care, makeup, right? And again, do we really need another brand of lipsticks? No, we have dozens, if not hundreds, of different brands of foundation and lipsticks and makeup. That's not the point. The point is what we call the unboxing experience, and how it makes you feel, and how you want to share this experience with others. So, of course, you'd have to read the book to learn more. That's my subtle plug here, if you will, Doug.
Feel free. Yeah.
But well, that's what's compelling. It's to learn from magicians and to learn from musicians and chefs and people that are not just marketers.
Right. And that's what I mentioned earlier about you're showing the reader some of the places they can go to get inspiration for their brands, their products, their customer experience that they might not have thought about. But also, you know, a number of the terms and concepts in the book are, I would think, you know, a glimpse into the future, certainly for me, because there were some terms that I just wasn't familiar with. And I was wondering if you could explain what the remix economy is and, you know, the implications that has for brands.
Yes, that's an important concept for readers, because it's to say you don't need to reinvent the wheel. Let me explain. The remix economy, it means copy, transform, and combine. What it means is most creations in the arts, in music, in marketing, or even in technologies are not original. Those creations, they're mostly made of existing ideas that are combined and transformed into something new. And
I think you're talking about an assemblage.
Precisely. That's exactly what it is. That's what electronic dance music is about. That's what hip hop is about. That's what food is about. Restaurants don't reinvent meat and sauces. They readapt and get inspiration from different influences.
Well, and I'm not a fast learner, you know, Emmanuel. I appreciate you kind of slowing down and talking to me, because
I'm not a smart man.
See, you remix too, Doug. You do that very well.
Right.
Bringing some sound bites, literal sound bites,
right,
and examples from pop culture into a marketing.
But even as we talk here, the assemblage concept becomes, I guess I get it more and more. So that's what I'm saying.
You got it.
I'm a slow learner, but thank you for your patience.
I don't know if you're a slow learner, but you are demonstrating as we speak what an assemblage is about and how we copy, transform, and combine what is already in existence. And so the remix economy is what we refer to as the gig economy and the creator economy and the consumer-to-consumer economies. And the opportunity is to leverage this to build an audience and monetize your talent. But really the call to action and the note of optimism to my readers is to say, you can do this. You can do it too. Mm-hmm. You don't have to reinvent the wheel In fact, most of the time you will not, and that's okay. You have to repurpose. You have to find new usage for existing products or existing brands. You have to combine various influences. You can, again, pick and choose and assemble a successful brand and a successful product.
Yes, and that's okay. I think it seems like so many companies, and not just as it relates to brands, developing a brand, but they think they have to start from scratch. It has to be new. I can remember years ago, an advertising client, we went and presented them this plan, an approach, and it was going to be very successful. We'd seen it work for others, but this was a little bit different. And I remember this client said, "But I've seen these ideas before." In other words, he wanted something completely new, out of the box thinking. And we said, "Well, you may have seen others do this in the past because a lot of this works really effectively, but you have to do it." No, I've seen these ideas before. Oh, he didn't last long at that job, but there was a cautionary tale. There was also, I just wanted to call back to something you mentioned earlier. I was trying to find it where you were talking about how people can see through, like the airport story you were telling about being carbon neutral. This was about that. You write, "Be mindful when aligning your brand with a cause. Today's discerning consumer can easily spot the difference between genuine purpose and marketing gimmicks." Oh, I think they have very sensitive BS meters, particularly the younger you get. But I just think people are a lot smarter than many companies think they are.
Indeed.
So let's talk again. This was just another really interesting thing about this is in the chapter on brand relevance. I wanted you to expand on this if you could, because this was, again, for me, a glimpse into the future. About the future of retail, in numerous categories where physical product demonstration and trial are not important, physical stores will become a fulfillment channel more than a purchase channel. Stores are already increasingly becoming pickup points and de facto fulfillment centers. Ultimately, brick-and-mortar stores will either focus on price, efficiency, and convenience, or become venues for unique premium experiences.
Correct. And here's the deal. A brick-and-mortar store cannot compete with Amazon on inventory. Why? Because if you go to Target and you want to buy some swim trunks, you'd have what? 20, 30, maybe 40 SKUs in there, right? Versus on Amazon, you'd have literally thousands. So a store is not going to compete on inventory. A store has to compete on the discovery, on the experience, on, if possible, the customer intimacy, the ability to guide and to counsel the customer through whatever she needs. And what all brands should harness is this concept of omnichannel marketing and online to offline to online again. So online to offline to online consumer journey. Look, I know it's not easy. I get it, because some of those brands, they grew as brick and mortar brands and then created an e-commerce platform. And now you have tensions between the teams and supply chain issues and so on and so forth. You have no choice but to figure that out. What I mean by online to offline to online is a consumer might choose a product online, pick it up in store. While in store, there is an opportunity to upsell and cross-sell additional products and deliver an experience that you could not deliver online. And then this consumer is going to leave and visit the website for additional beauty tips, for example, when shopping at Sephora, and talk about the product on social media and maybe buy additional companion items on the website again. All this to say that you really have, as a brand, as an advertiser, as a marketer, you have to, once again, look at the world through the lens of your consumer. Nobody cares if you have different sales targets and different P&Ls and different sales teams and marketing teams for the e-commerce platform versus the store. Nobody cares about this. People want to shop seamlessly across channels, and this experience is complementary. there isn't a competition per se between your online platform and your brick and mortar store. There is an opportunity to deliver an experience across channel. And that's why so many DTC brands open brick and mortar stores, Casper Mattress and Warby Parker, and we could go on and on. Those are DTC brands that now go for brick and mortar retail. Conversely, we of course see many retail brands going online and on social. So that is the reality of the world we live in, and that is what you have to do as a brand to deliver a compelling experience.
So let me jump to what was probably the section that most interested me. It was just revelatory, and I wanted to quote it and ask you to expand on it, because I think if people understand this, they will have gone a long way. You write, Silicon Valley's holy grail is product market fit. But today's winners, realizing that there are so many products and limited markets, think about what they're bringing to the world differently. For them, it's about solution need fit, where knowing your customers and their current needs, anticipating their future needs, and exceeding their expectations around fulfilling needs at any point in time results in solutions that serve rather than products to push.
Yes, I think an example of this thinking is in the news literally as we speak, is why is AI taking off now? Because as a user, as a consumer, as an individual, I understand the benefits that AI delivers to me. This is why ChatGPT ramped up from 0 to 1 million users in a matter of 30 days. And to put things in perspective, it took Netflix 3.5 years to get to 1 million users. And I think it took Instagram 1 year and 18 months to get to 1 million users. All this to say that when you leverage artificial intelligence as part of search, as a user, as a person, you understand the benefit. It simplifies and it clarifies things for me. It provides me with a service, with a solution that is innovative and helpful to me, to my friends, to my family, period. In contrast, I think that is why it's taking so much time and billions of dollars for the metaverse to take off. See, that's another thing that marketers are bubbled and need to look at the real world. 16 months ago, when the metaverse, when Meta launched, there was all that buzz about, oh, we're going to open stores in the metaverse and let's buy some $600 virtual sneakers and all that. Well, fast track to today, the metaverse right now is still very anecdotal. You have very, very few users and they're gamers and they are very early adopters and it has yet to go mainstream. The reason being is it's hard for people to understand how does this technology benefits me? What is it going to do for me to pay $600 for some pixelated sneakers? In sharp contrast with artificial intelligence, as we experience it in 2023, that is becoming something very real. And that saves me time and energy and does the work for me.
Well said. Let me ask something from chapter 9, which, again, we're just, these are the greatest hits, Emmanuel, for this particular reader. I'm sure everyone else who reads it, different things are going to resonate. But you write that, and for a moment there, I thought you were talking about me, as consumers were drowning in stuff, tears, and trash. That's not true. During the lockdown, I cleared a lot of clutter out of my house. But we're drowning in stuff, tears, and trash. But then in the next page, you write, the problem might not be consumerism per se, but rather the brands and the products themselves. Can you talk about that?
And that's where brands have an opportunity to make a positive impact on people and society, whereby brands can sell less, but better products. And brands can encourage people to recycle and upcycle products. And I know it might sound counterintuitive, but it's really the key to sustainability and sustainability in terms of the world around us, the environment, climate change and all this. But it's also the key to the sustainability of a brand to become meaningful to people over time. And examples of brands that do this well, one is Levi's, for example, or Lululemon, whereby you can bring back your old jeans or your gently worn yoga pants, and the brand will give you a store credit and give the product a second life, selling it to someone else. And the opportunity for the consumer is to give a second life to that product. So we're going back to what you described earlier, Doug, that is the permanence and the reassurance about the past, the present, and future. And the opportunity for the brand is to attract to the brand people who could not have accessed the brand otherwise. So if you take Lululemon, those yoga pants are great, but they're not cheap. Now that you resell them as a used, gently worn garment, it makes the brand accessible to more people, and it brings... It's basically customer acquisition. It brings consumers to the brand that will then pay a premium and full price for other items in store. And those people would not have come to the store had it not been for this used product. A third example for our European listeners is IKEA. IKEA has built its reputation around cheap furniture that you can assemble yourself quick and easy. Yet, IKEA is still responsible for a lot of waste because people don't keep their IKEA furniture, especially when you move houses, and they dispose of them. Well, IKEA started an initiative where, again, you can bring back your used furniture and IKEA will resell them to, other shoppers. So those are examples of brands that encourage recycling and upcycling, whereby you're giving the product a second life and everyone wins. The environment, we describe this, the brand, because you attract new audiences to your brand, and also consumers, because those products are becoming more meaningful because they had a previous life, and now you're giving them a second life.
Another thing that's important here, and I've seen this, and there was, in fact, a book on the show, I think in 2018, called Do Good by Ann Barr Thompson, where she talked about this. But it's not going away. Again, another glimpse into the future, or it's already here, but people are going to look at it more. Let's see. You write that in the past, brands rarely had their own manufacturing plants, and they relied on, and I love the way you wrote this, an opaque system of subcontractors. So it's almost like they didn't have to take responsibility. And I think it was in your book where you talk about there was a terrible fire.
Yeah.
In a country, and they found all these labels like from Benetton, and even Benetton didn't know, and some others.
No.
They didn't even know their stuff was being made in this sweatshop, basically. But then you also write that brands that communicate transparently on production costs and even sensitive information increase consumers' perception of authenticity and drive trust, as well as positive sentiment toward the brand. And I can remember this coming up in somewhere in the last couple of years, talking about, you know, supply chain like Nike or Apple. And I don't know exactly what the situation was, but it's almost like the fact that people were asking that question was casting aspersions on those brands.
Correct. So especially in clothing apparel, the supply chain has been opaque, to say the least, for a long time. But again, a shift we see with younger generations, with our younger shoppers, is they're mindful of labor practices, of supply chains. And in other words, it's no longer okay to buy a t-shirt for cheap if it's at the expense of the life of a child on the other side of the world making that t-shirt. That's also why, going back to upcycling and recycling, but you see Gen Z and you see millennials going towards used clothing and going towards vintage items. Pulp Fiction t-shirts are very successful on campus at UCLA, which is rather ironic because the movie came out 30 years ago now. It came out in 93-ish, 93, 94. So obviously none of those people were born there.
T-shirts from that era, or they're...
Maybe not the Pulp Fiction one, but definitely Guns N' Roses, for example. I see some true vintage Guns N' Roses t-shirts. It's not just something that has been recently reprinted.
Oh, okay.
All this to say that labor practices and the supply chain and transparency is becoming so important. And in a way, I'm thinking almost out loud, but that is also what makes the success of luxury brands. Now, listen, I understand that most brands cannot do what Louis Vuitton and Hermès and those people do. But if you think about luxury marketing, one thing they do extremely well is you know about the manufacturing process. You know that Louis Vuitton is made in France. You know that Jaeger-LeCoultre and Rolex are made in Switzerland. And you can see the workshops and the crafts that goes into it. And you know that Bentley and Rolls-Royce and Aston Martin are made in the UK and that Prada is made in Italy and so on and so forth. So I think it's reassuring. It's not just reassuring. It's uplifting for consumers to know where and how the product has been manufactured. And in clothing apparel, there was a brand that did a lot of things wrong. It was American Apparel. They did one thing right. So they did a lot of things wrong. But the one thing they did right is made in Los Angeles. We're making garments here, downtown Los Angeles. And that was such an important selling point. And that accounts for such a large share of the success of the brand.
Yes, I don't see how companies can go wrong if they're more transparent about their supply chain, assuming they have it in good shape. And it also seems like it's a great opportunity to add to the story.
It is.
Of the brand. So a couple weeks ago, I think I was listening to the Wall Street Journal podcast, the news podcast, and they were talking about, could have been John Deere, where they're allowing farmers to repair their own equipment. And then you wrote about that. No, you didn't write about that specifically, but I was wondering if you could talk about what the right to repair movement is, because right after I read it, I was talking to somebody and they happened to mention it. Again, this is why I got to keep reading these books. What is the right to repair movement?
The right to repair movement is the fight, a way to fight programmed obsolescence. The right to repair movement is to say that most products we use could last for much longer than they do. However, those products are programmed by the manufacturer so that they don't last, so that you replace them. And the right to repair movement is to say, I want to be able to fix a product that works 95% right. If only I could find that one piece, and if only I could get to replace that one piece that doesn't work well in the product, and I could do so in a fairly seamless and ineffective fashion.
Without necessarily having to go to the manufacturer?
Or maybe having to go to the manufacturer, but without getting price gouging or things like this, right? So that's the right to repair movement, is the ability to keep the product, repair the product. Again, we're trying to sell less but better, and that means to create products and brands that are more meaningful to people. And if you want to foster loyalty and foster a relationship with people, it's going to be about this product lasting for a long time. Because we say that people, consumers, are no longer loyal to brands, which they're not in most cases. And that's also because brands don't give them a reason to be. Because if you make a crap t-shirt that is going to get all discolored after washing it 3-4 times, well, you will have no hesitation moving into onto another brand. That's where it becomes important to make a better product and a product that you can fix so that people keep them longer, develop a personal history around this particular product and keep it for longer, and then buy from your brand again and again.
Yeah, is this right to repair movement, does it have more traction like in Europe than it does in the United States?
Often, for anything that has to do with sustainability, it has more traction in Europe first than it does in the United States. So the short answer is yes. We see this again at Ipsos in our studies. If you go to, especially the big five, yeah? So the big five, France, Germany, UK, Italy, Spain, they're more conscious about the environment than we are in North America. But we're getting there. We're just slower to adapt for many reasons. And also, mind you, you know, they can ride the train between cities versus, as much as I would love to, I don't think that I would ride the train from Los Angeles to New York. So all this to say that they're more conscious about the environment, and they're also, and therefore are earlier adopters than we are. But it's getting traction here, especially in tech products. Battery life is a classic. You know, you don't want to have to change your laptop because the battery died, and replacing that battery is $300 when buying a new laptop will be $500. So all this to say that this movement is gaining traction in the US and will over the next few years.
Well, I enjoyed reading about that. It sparked an interest in wanting to learn more about it. Let's jump just to one or two other things before we wrap up. And I was wondering, towards the end, you talk about the arts. And talk about how the arts can enable the creation of powerful and purposeful brands.
Yes, that's where this book is an inspiration for readers. At least that's what I intend it to be. And that's why this book, I think, is important. Is it's fine to look at brands for best practices, but let's look at artists and chefs and musicians. It's an inspiration because of how they create their products, meaning the artists we admire the most, they're talented, but not necessarily in the way we think they are. Those artists are very often assemblers, meaning they deliver on an artistic vision. That doesn't mean that they create the work of art themselves. So what I mean by this is, if you look at restaurants, someone like Alain Ducasse owns 30 plus restaurants. Someone like Gordon Ramsay, they don't cook anymore. They certainly, Alain Ducasse cooks once every 2 years. He admits this himself. He says, I cook in my head. I cook in my mind. Mm-hmm. The point is to say that. So, and if you look at visual arts, Jeff Koons has a whole team of people. So did Andy Warhol. So did Michelangelo. In music, that's DJ Khaled. That's what he does. That's what DJs, David Guetta and Afrojack, those people, that's what they do. They assemble from other artists. And that is to say, the art is to deliver on an artistic vision, is to have a vision for the art and then orchestrate, assemble the skill sets and the components they need to deliver on that vision. And that is exactly what I believe you should do in branding. You should have a vision for what the brand is and what it can do for people and what you want the brand to become. And from there, you're going to assemble the skill sets and the cultural and social and economical inputs you need to create your brand assemblage.
Yes, and let's get let's get personal here. You talk about how art, creativity, design, and culture also benefit our professional lives. Explain.
That's creativity is all, again an opportunity from Instagram, from social media, whereby the arts and creativity is no longer the exclusivity of an elite. What this means is, yes, you can still go to Art Basel, and sure, 0.1% of people go to Sotheby's and Christie's and spend $50 million, $60 million on a painting in about 2 minutes. But again, the arts is no longer the exclusivity of an elite. Mm-hmm. We all have access to virtual exhibitions, and we all have the opportunity to make art with our smartphones. And we all have the opportunity to look at how artists create their art so that we can replicate this process in whatever we do.
Yes, and let me just add to that. You write, in the next few years, AI and machine learning, which we've been talking about already, will replace millions of bookkeeping clerks, market research analysts, and telemarketers. The bright spot is that machines cannot be trained to be creative. Big ideas and critical thinking remain exclusive to humans. Art and creativity empower indispensability for employees and brands. So at the very end of the book, you have some parting advice on how to put in action many of the ideas from your book. Let me just ask about one. Explain what you mean when you recommend to sell your brand by telling people not to buy it.
What inspired me to write this is years ago, I was in Las Vegas and I went to a show by the magicians, Penn and Teller.
Yes.
They're so funny, those guys. And by the way, that's I learned a lot about marketing seeing their show as magicians. And anyway, the ad was, and you know, they look so funny, those two dudes. And the tagline was, less injuries than last year.
I have that underlined here. I loved it.
Less audience. I think the exact tagline is less audience injuries than last year. And I thought that was just so good. Most recent example was on Black Friday when we heard, I believe it was Patagonia, to say, do not buy this jacket.
Was it REI or Patagonia?
Oh, I think it was REI.
Where they closed... Yeah. Their store
closed on Black Friday.
Yeah, because they wanted their employees to go outside or something like that.
Right, and Patagonia had that ad that says "Do not buy this jacket." There is I'll grab another example from a podcast you're likely familiar with. Media personality Scott Galloway, and one of his taglines is Elon Musk described Scott Galloway as a unsufferable numbskull. And so
that's a badge of honor for Scott Galloway.
That's a badge of honor for Scott. So the point is to say it's counterintuitive to tell people do not buy the product, but it actually sheds light on the value of the brand by doing so. And once again, it's this counterintuitive move of saying less is more. Less is more because you might sell less, but products that will become more valuable to people, and by the way, at a higher margin. Mm-hmm. So in the end, everyone is better off.
Yes, it's got transparency, and it's also a reminder that not every prospect is a good customer. You don't need to be for everyone.
Exactly. Very few brands are for everyone. Maybe Petro Convenience can be an exception. There are very, very few brands that are for everyone. But you should not be...
Yeah, the most successful ones seem to understand that, and they're very comfortable with it. So it's counterintuitive, just like telling people not to buy your brand, but very successful. So, Emmanuel, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
This book is empowering. That is what I want people to remember, and it's optimistic, and it gives you the tools to succeed. And the key takeaway, and I think that's important, it doesn't matter if you 20 plus years marketing experience, you might be a C-level executive with an M&A type of background, or you might be 6 months out of college or you might be in college. In any case, what's important is we're going back to Ogilvy. That's how you introduced our conversation, Doug, is senior people don't have the monopoly over great ideas. What works is an assemblage of ideas and an assemblage of people. And that is why, of course, it's important to have senior executives make decisions, give directions, and deliver on the vision. Yet, you should and you want the contribution of those more junior people because they're very attuned to culture. So that's to say, if you're a C-level executive, you should read Assemblage because it's going to provide you with the tools to deliver on your vision for your brand and your company. And if you're 6 months out of college or you have 2, 3, 4, 6, 7 years professional experience, you should also read the book because it's going to empower you to make an impact in the boardroom and to make yourself look good to your clients and to your boss and to people around you because you bring a different perspective on the world of consumption, consumerism, and great brands.
Mm. You know, that reminds me of how much I always liked when a new employee would start because they would ask questions like, why are you doing it this way? Why are you doing it that way? Mm. Most of the time, it was a good question. But after a while, they kind of got into the groove and they wouldn't ask those kind of questions. And I was like, oh, that's a great question. Keep asking those questions. I don't know why we didn't think of that. So if you're a new employee out there, I hope you're with an organization where they're hankering for fresh feedback from you. So what is one thing a listener could do today to put in action one of the ideas from your book that we've talked about, just to get them moving in that direction? Give them something to do. Give them some homework, Professor.
Go on a field trip. Go on a field trip. Close the laptop. Close the lid of your. Stop the emails. That's what you can do today. Mm-hmm. Take a Friday afternoon off, and you're going to go. You can go to a shopping mall. That's great. You can also go to explore a new neighborhood. You can go to a museum you know nothing about and an artist you know nothing about. Oh, and by the way, you might not like the art, and that's completely fine. I'm saying this because I took a day off yesterday for one of those field trips, and I went to the Getty Center here in Los Angeles.
Oh, the Getty Center. Yeah. So this was in preparation for your marketing book podcast interview.
Exactly. See?
Thank you.
I actually really didn't like the art. I really didn't like what I saw.
Is that the first time you've been there?
No, I go there. I try to go there on a regular basis. That's one of the great upsides of living in Los Angeles, right? Is you can do that type of things without much logistics. So I didn't like the art. However, I learned about how this artist, she worked with the light and how the art was an inspiration from the Dutch painter Mondrian and how she would play with lines. And that gave me some ideas about products and about brands. So the parting advice, if you will, is take a field trip. You don't have to go to museums and look at paintings. If you don't like museums and paintings, go to a stand-up comedy show. That's just as relevant, okay? Or look at pictures and grab some magazines. Maybe go to a bookstore or maybe go to Urban Outfitter or like a vintage type of store.
But maybe example. Someplace new.
Someplace new, yeah. Exactly. And it's fine to go somewhere you don't like. You don't have to like what you see. You don't have to agree with what they do. But it will open your mind to cultural influences and commercial influences that will eventually translate into your thinking and therefore your products and brand.
Great advice. Shut the damn laptop. Get out of the office. Go do something new. Give yourself a new experience. So looking back, what books have most inspired your working career?
There are quite a few. I'll think through something I read recently, which I thought was very good. And I think it was on your podcast, by the way, Dan Pink. And Dan Pink, the book his latest book is The Power of Regrets. And I think the tagline for the book is looking backward takes us forward. But anyway, I thought the book was very, very well done, whereby he did a survey at scale, the survey of regrets, whatever he called it. But anyway, it's a study at scale of what do we regret and why and how can we learn from our regrets. And I thought it was very well done because it's both a quantitative study, because he spoke with thousands of people, and also a qualitative one that is going deep and a true understanding of what we regret and what we could do and what we could do differently as an outcome. So I thought that was a very, very strong book. That's a book that moved me. And frankly, that the framework for this book will be an inspiration for my next book.
Oh, interesting. What about your career in academia? Are there any books that pushed you in that direction? I know you mentioned Ogilvy. I know one of his books is one of the two that's had the biggest impact on my working career.
Yeah, Ogilvy is a strong book because it's an evergreen. Again, if you read Ogilvy on advertising today, which many people do, it's just as relevant as it was when it first came out. In terms of the other books that influenced me, Martin Lindstrom was clearly an innovator, a pioneer. Forgive me, Doug, I was looking for the right word. A pioneer in neuroscience. And for example, you know, when he did those, he did a lot of work on the brain, and he established, as an example, that cigarettes, if you display a picture of someone sick on a cigarette packet, well, that actually doesn't turn people off. So that's all to say that he was one of the pioneers of what we call today neuroscience, and of course has evolved and has gained a lot of traction.
Might that have been his book, Biology?
Yeah, that's correct. Uh-huh. That's the one, and there's Biology, and there's another one. The name escapes me, but
he wrote Brand Sense and Brand Wash.
Brand Sense is the one. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Brainwashed as well. And so his latest book is on small data. Well, that's not his latest book. It's a little, but he has a book on small data that's also interesting. Yes. He did a lot of work on Lego. Uh-huh. He used to work, and that's fascinating. It's a small is big type of book, if you will, and looking at the small details. And again, that's where qualitative data is important. That's where ethnography is so important. We spoke about OXO, and that is how they developed the products, because the founder's wife, she had arthritis. And by observing how she would use kitchen utensils, that's how he decided, the founder, to start the brand. P&G was well known for many years. To travel, their CEO will travel to Asia and spend an ungodly number of days in Asia to understand how consumers will use the products in their homes. So,
you know what his book Small Data reminds me of is what you said earlier: shut your laptop, get out of the office, and go talk to people. Yeah. And there were so many things in that book where he talked about the insights people had, and then I can't remember the company. I don't think it was P&G, but he said there was one client that they realized how powerful that was, so they mandated that every employee, I think it was some sort of medical device company, every employee spend 24 hours with a customer a year, and it forced them into their homes to observe them. And they got so many great ideas about how to add a lot more value to their customers.
I think that's very powerful. It reminds me, almost 20 years ago, over 15 years ago, when I lived in London, I once went to Pret-a-Manger, which is a chain of upmarket sandwich stores, if you will, right? And they make coffee as well. They compete with Coffee Bean and Tea Leaves and Starbucks and the likes. And I was meeting with a senior executive that day at their headquarters, and it was first thing in the morning. And he said, "Would you like a coffee?" Of course, I said, "Sure, I want a coffee." And he made the coffee for me. And I was so impressed to see a senior executive making a perfect cafe latte, and he would even make the design on the foam and everything. And he told me, well, at Pret, all of us are trained on how to make coffee. We have to know how to make coffee. Now, granted, you know, that's not to say a C-level executive should spend his days making coffees and filling the shelves at store level. That said, I thought it was very humbling and very enabling to see a senior executive holding such command of the product and the service they deliver to their client.
Yes, and it also seems like a clever way to get those people into the stores.
Yeah.
Like, get back there and talk to your customers. Interesting.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, those are great. Those are great books. Well, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable, including all the books that have been mentioned, and your Ipsos site and so forth, and your LinkedIn profile and your Twitter account. And now a word to you, dear listeners. Please do me a big favor, particularly all you French-speaking listeners. Please reach out in some way to Emmanuel and congratulate him on the book and thank him for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. And I should add, he is a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, so like you, listener, he is not an unattractive man. He's a good-looking guy, okay? So send him a message on LinkedIn or Twitter or whatever, but the guests on the show have told me that they really enjoy hearing from Marketing Book Podcast listeners, and not just because Marketing Book Podcast listeners are so ridiculously good-looking. And if you are listening on your smartphone and you have subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app, like Spotify or Apple Podcasts, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. The book is Assemblage, The Art and Science of Brand Transformation. The author is Emmanuel Probst. Dr. Probst, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Doug, thank you so much for having me. And thank you to our listeners for spending time with us today. And thank you, Doug, for inspiring our community and our listeners.
My pleasure. And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. Special thanks to this episode's sponsor, Marketing Architects, creators of the all-inclusive TV advertising concept that's so revolutionary, they wrote a book about it. For a copy of the book, All-Inclusive TV, How Booming Brands Are Reimagining TV Advertising, visit this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com or visit marketingarchitects.com/book and tell them you heard about it on the Marketing Book Podcast. And if you are one of the legions of listeners who have left an iTunes review, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast stuff. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the late, great Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."
This Valentine's Day, Dunkin's got the perfect pairings to show your love. So get down on one knee with a dozen brownie batter donuts and a cocoa mocha signature latte. Or make them swoon with a strawberry dragon fruit Dunkin' refresher with a Cupid's Choice donut. Are you ready for love? America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer.